Well, it's another just ho-hum uneventful week here for D.C. Signal to Noise. I'm John Harris, news director for Farm Journal, joined as always by the diviner of Signal to Noise, Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers Policy Analyst, and Annalisa Laca, who is the, she writes policy for AgWeb and is also the dairy editor for Farm Journal. And we have a special guest alongside today because we have had so many questions about the CARES Act and the small business loans that are available through that we brought in the man who has all of the answers, Paul Niefer from Clifton Larson Allen. We'll get to him in just a little bit. But first, Jim, let's talk about the updates from today. We had a push to get, if you count in both sides, another $500 billion in coronavirus aid, and both sides of the aisle blocked the measure in the Senate. What were the sticking points?
Well, the sticky points from the Democratic side is they tried to broaden, you know, the package, and that was a no-go on the Republican side. And I think both sides had arguments to play, but eventually this thing's going to get through. In fact, we call it Phase 3 Plus, as opposed to the fourth package. You still have a lot of money to chew through relative to the Small Business Administration loan. So as the clock keeps ticking on that, so will the pressure to get the two sides, you know, to agree. They'll continue to have meetings and they'll eventually come up with compromises, John.
Yeah, you point out tranche 3.1 of the aid, because it was largely add-ons to existing programs, add-ons to the money for the Small Business Administration loans, add-ons for some of the assistance that's been made available for hospitals and for states in combating the virus. But Jim, isn't there a danger for both parties in this to not come to the Senate floor with an agreed upon package, rather than throwing out these packages that they know are going to get stonewalled by the other party?
Oh, I think the next time they bring it up, there probably will be an agreed on, you know, package. It was mostly show. You hate
yeah,
to
but
what see
are you,
that.
What are you showing now with failure to pass aid for such a crucial need?
They were talking to their individual parties again, as Congress, as this town usually does, John. So they weren't in the disaster mode, you know, today. Again, the Democrats wanted to add other things, including a pretty big increase in food stamp funding. Now, you can't say that that's not needed, but in what type of package? The Republicans said, let's add on to this very popular SBA programs, plural, while we have an opportunity here, and then we'll continue to talk relative to a true, you know, phase four package. And that just wasn't the case. So you hate to say it's politics, but they were speaking to their parties.
What are you hearing now about that phase four package? Any inklings yet of what it will look like?
Well, they're going to continue to see how COVID-19 plays out, and also the timeline for hopefully getting the country, you know, back to work. Most people say at the earliest May 1, and probably into May, and as you know, it's probably going to be a rolling, you know, bring back. You have other people saying you cannot get any major improvements to get people back to work until you significantly increase the number of tests throughout the U.S. To get right now per capita, we're testing one out of every 300 people. Germany's one out of every 100 people. Now, I know we have a lot more, you know, people than Germany, but I think you're going to have to get close to that German ratio before you have the confidence to get people back, as opposed to what could be in phase four package. We'll have a little more time. I think you're not going to see it until the end of April, if not into May, to better define what we need, John.
But especially when you talk about things like making more test kits available, okay, if you approve the bill now, by the time you release the spending and actually make the purchases and then distribute, you're probably talking a couple months, and we're at the point then where they're saying we may be past the peak.
But saying you're past the peak and needing, you know, continued aid, they're not divergent here. We're going to, most, I think, legitimate analysts in this situation say we're not going to be back to the new normal, whatever it is, until sometime early next year. So it's going to take time to get this great country back in the economic front.
All right. Well, speaking of that, let's turn to Annalisa. And you have been doing a lot of digging this week and talking with those in the dairy industry, including former USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, about how they're trying to shore up the dairy industry amid this and now increased milk dumping. Where do we stand now? What actions are being taken?
So the National Milk Producers Federation and the International Dairy Foods Association sent a joint proposal to USDA asking them to do a variety of things. From a producer standpoint, they're asking producers to reduce their production by 10% and then be paid some kind of aid for the remaining production. They're also asking USDA to guarantee that producers who are dumping their milk will get paid for it, because I think we talked about this briefly last week, but it's up to the co-op's discretion to determine whether or not producers will be paid for that milk. So, National Milk would like to see USDA step in and handle that. And then also, we've talked about it multiple times, but we expect to see a large purchase of dairy products from USDA, and the groups are really hoping that those could get donated to food banks. So lots of things going on. Lots of people trying to get the situation figured out. But I think, we mentioned it last week, it's really complex. The dairy industry is very diverse, and there's no one-size-fits-all solution for every producer. So it'll be a challenge, to say the least.
Indeed. Has the talk of reopening the dairy margin program, has that died down, or is there still a push for that?
No, there's still a push for that. So, that is one of the things also included in the proposal. They would like to see the dairy margin coverage program reopened at no penalty for producers to join and at the same level of coverage as producers who previously joined. Others in the industry are saying, sure, let's go ahead and let them in, but let's charge them a little bit more. Let's not allow them to cover quite as much milk. So there is still some debate going on about that. And, Secretary Perdue has likened it to fire insurance. So, jury's out on whether or not he will do that, but that is one of the things that they're asking for.
Well, the secretary is probably right in that regard. As we discussed last week, it would be moral hazard. And let's just say I talked to some White House people this week about this who were inquiring about this from an agriculture perspective. And I just said, if you open up that dairy program for the dairy producers who had not once but twice with an extension to come into this program, you better do the same thing for corn and soybean growers if this commodity cash price continues to go lower and those people who chose the ARC program want to come back in to the PLC program. That's called equity. And I told them to do a ratio of every cent you have to pay to a corn producer. You talk about a lot of money.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Jim, I remember you last week telling us that we would see a proposal come forward on dairy this week. We saw the request from the dairy industry that Annalisa just talked about, but nothing out of Congress or the White House yet.
No, but, Perdue signaled to us yesterday, I think these days are long, or the day before, that is going to come within a week or two. They're getting close. What USDA has done, and it's a good, they've asked, not that they can write the programs, but they've sought inquiries from commodity groups and major farm groups to see what suggestions that they had, and they're trying to fit all that together in a package. Obviously earmarked, I think, initially for the cattle and dairy industries, hopefully the produce industries, because that's a perishable sector that needs help. And when he said that the additional $14 billion for the Commodity Credit Corporation Borrowing Authority really can't be tapped until early July, that was a clear signal again from the secretary that row crop programs will not come until later, this summer. I will tell you there's some controversy relative to some of the suggestions they may be getting in, including, let's call it, the production cut in dairy. Usually Republican administrations are not in favor of that, probably for a pretty good reason. Those people who don't comply with any production reduction, they're usually very efficient producers, and they make such programs ineffective. And that's a history will bear that out as well. So I will be surprised if they go that route, but this town makes mistakes all the time.
I was just curious, Jim, this is the first time in my recollection that we've ever as an industry asked for even a voluntary supply management program. I mean, am I off base there? Have we gone down this route before?
Yeah, National Milk has.
Okay.
If I recall. Yes.
Well, and Jim, if they do, let's say the industry or they're allowed to cut production by 10%, what happens when we get back to the normal and demand really snaps back and now we don't have the cows available to meet that demand and pricing goes up to $24 a hundredweight, then, the problem is the rubber band, yes, it's been stretched too far one way. Then if you make too many cuts or too many changes on that direction, then when it snaps back the other way, then you have issues on that end.
Yeah. Usually the best in this environment, for at least from my experience, is direct payments to aid in the cash flow concerns, loan type programs for processors to keep in business, and three, a major increase in government purchases for a host of outlets, including food distribution, banks, and other areas. And that's a pretty good triad of outlets, at least for the dairy sector and the meats. I think the biggest thing for meat would be purchases and direct payments. That combo is a fairly I shouldn't say attractive, it should be fairly effective in stemming some of the cash flow needs out in farmland.
All right, well, speaking of those cash flow needs out in farmland and elsewhere, we've been getting a ton of questions about the small business loans through the CARES Act and what in agriculture might be eligible. And before we turn to Paul Niefer from Clifton Larson Allen, if you haven't yet, go to agweb.com and look at some of the columns that he has written on that. In fact, I'm going to link to all of those columns in the story for the Signal to Noise podcast this week. He's covered nearly everything you can imagine in the CARES Act and how it affects your finances and your ability to apply, etc. So be sure to check those out. But going to turn it over to you, Jim and Paul, because you guys have been following this issue very closely. And let's clear up some of the muddy water here.
Well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Paul. He is a principal. I believe I'm handling this right, Paul. Tell me if I'm wrong. Principal at Clifton, Larson and Allen in Yakima, Washington. He has the uncanny ability to write in English on complex subjects in this area. And that's why his blog is so popular in farm country.
Well, thank you. It is sometimes tougher to write in English than to write in legalese. I will say that.
Well, I want to go through a couple of your last blogs. What are we're going to try to answer some questions, but you've raised some questions relative to the PPP program and elsewhere. Can you go through a couple of them, Paul?
Yeah, I think we sort of understand how the typical farm operation that has employees, how that's handled. As of yet, unless you've seen something, Jim, the SBA has not issued any guidance on how to handle self-employed farmers. They're supposed to be able to start applying for a loan tomorrow, but without the guidance, how do you calculate self-employment income? As a tax preparer, we typically look at Schedule SE, that's the self-employment schedule on a taxpayer's tax return. But with a lot of farmers, that schedule typically shows zero or a negative. because they might have a lot of trade-ins on farm equipment that shows up income on Form 4797, which is where you report that. So that's definitely how do you report, or I mean, how do you determine that? What's eligible? And then over on the loan forgiveness side, we have some issues there. They're talking about how you can have to use at least 75% for payroll costs, and then you could use 25% for interest on mortgages, rent payments, and utility payments, but they all had to be in effect as of February 15th. You're also not allowed to prepay interest to get that, you know, to have that count. It has to be the interest that's technically due. And then the question I had in the blog this morning is, a lot of farmers make annual mortgage payments. So does all of that interest that they pay during that 8-week covered period, does that all qualify, or is it only the interest that really accrued during that 8-week period? So there's quite a few questions that we have in that area. I think I'll hesitate, or I mean, I'll stop right now so you can throw in maybe a couple more questions on that, because I know I got other areas where that we have some concerns too.
Well, any you know, farmer or operator that's listening, if you have individual questions, email them in. John, where would they just send it to Signal to Noise or AgWeb or what?
Send it to me at jherath@farmjournal.com. That's jherath@farmjournal.com.
And I'm going to send those questions to people I know who would very likely help us out. And this goes for you, Paul, too. I've got your questions in. And one of those is Senator John Hoeven's office. His chief of staff, Cassie Bladow, is very good. And I'm not saying she'll turn it around in one day, but they have the direct call lines into the SBA and the business committees in Congress. So hopefully they can help us out. And Paul, I believe there's going to be some more information coming out either tonight or very soon relative to the self-employed. At least that's what I was told this morning. So maybe, hopefully, that'll help us out.
Yeah, it needs to, because like I say, the application, self-employed are starting or able to start applying for it tomorrow. And if you don't have guidance on how to apply for it, you know, what's going to happen there? And of course, the Senate bill that was sort of leaked last night had a provision in there specifically stating that farmers, all farm operations qualify for the PPP loan. We all along sort of was touting the fact that it was, but the SBA was sort of pigeonholing it into their programs. You know, the actual law was very specific, but I think sometimes rulemakers in certain administrations forget to read the law. You know, they're so used to doing their own type of deals, and they think the new law applies. In reality, it's a wide-ranging ability for any business under 500 employees definitely qualifies.
And again, any listener who has a state SBA office that tells them that the farm sector does not qualify for the PPP, email us on that one, and we'll make sure that their boss tells them they're wrong.
Well, and another thing that was happening too is a lot of these banks, I reviewed a loan application for a large bank in the Southeast. They were having the applicant reduce the loan by the amount of federal income tax withheld and the FICA and all that was being withheld from the employee's paycheck. That was wrong. We got clarity on that a couple days ago, so that was helpful. And then also we're hearing that some banks are actually reducing the loan amount that they allow the farmer or the taxpayer to qualify for, because all they want to loan is what they think the loan amount is going to be forgiven. But that's not the law. The law states that you can qualify based on your payroll. So I think some of those banks, personally, in my opinion, have some lender issues that might arise if the farmer or the taxpayer qualified for a $500,000 loan and the bank only gave them $300,000. I definitely think there's some issues there.
Okay. And what about, I know one question you raised, Paul, was if someone employee quit during this period of time of which it covers, were you ever able to get an answer on that? Would the replaced associate?
No, we definitely, no, we're waiting on that. And that we may get guidance on that a little bit later, although there's a lot of people now, if they've gotten their money, their 8-week period is starting now, so it's very important for them to understand that. So let me just briefly describe what the issue is. There's a testing for your employees that generally make less than $100,000. You look at the wages that were paid during that 8-week period that they're in that covered period. Then you look back to the first quarter of 2020. You take the wages that that employee was paid during the first quarter of 2020. You multiply it by 75%. So let's pretend like an employee got paid, let's say, $20,000. 75% of $20,000 is $15,000. Then you look at what was the employee paid during the 8 weeks of the covered period, and let's say the employee was paid $15,000, then there wouldn't be any reduction in that loan forgiveness. But let's say the employee quits 2 days after the 8-week period starts and got paid $200. In that case, you're going to have $14,800 of loan forgiveness eliminated, and you're still going to be on the hook for $14,800, even though you may have gone out and hired another employee to take that person's place. So that's the way the law is written. Now, the interpretation by SBA may be a little bit better than that, but that's the way the law is, very specific on how it's written. That's how we're supposed to calculate that part of the loan that's not forgiven. So if you have a complete turnover in your employees, but you've paid exactly the same amount of wages that you would have, but it's a complete turnover and it happened on the first day, essentially in that situation, 75% of your loan's not going to be forgiven. And I don't think that's what the farmer or what the taxpayer was counting on.
Anna, I think you had a question.
I did. And that point, Paul, really, from a dairy perspective, is really frightening, because employee turnover is really high traditionally on dairies. Yep. But my question was more related to banks. We happen to bank with an ag credit branch, and we got an email from them basically saying, like, hey, we don't know enough about any of this to help you process. I mean, it was just like a mass email to all of their borrowers, I'm sure. But are you seeing that from other banks as well?
Well, on the farm credit side, they were never really a participant much at all in the SBA programs. You know, the CARES Act opened it up to them. I know there's certainly some farm credit agencies out there that I think are really up to speed or trying to get up to speed. We've had conversations with a couple of those. There's other farm credit banks and some large ones. They're saying, we're not really doing these. Go ahead, and here's a couple local banks that you can deal with. So that's sort of happening, or at least that's what I'm seeing out there right now. And then another thing that's come up, and I'm starting to hear more and more of this, and I get a little bit concerned, and it certainly would be applicable for dairies. The law is very, very specific that any worker that you have, the wages that you pay to any worker whose principal residence is outside the U.S., i.e. or e.g. H-2A and H-2B workers, that none of that labor qualifies for a PPP loan. I've already heard from certain farmers out there. Now, thankfully, so far, these haven't been my clients, but I've heard from certain farmers saying, hey, we're putting those wages down. We're going to get a loan on it. And it's up for them to find out that that worker doesn't qualify. And, you know, my concern is at that point, if you know, and the USDA frequently asked questions that was released yesterday, I think it's yesterday, is very specific. H-2A, H-2B don't qualify. Therefore, people know this now. If they knowingly put those employees down and it's later found out that they did that knowingly, I think you open yourself up to some fraud penalties and or jail. You know, that's one of the things that was written into the law or the SBA program. So just be very careful. Now, I listed this one person. We found out later on that it was a, an H-2A worker, an H-2B worker, and you just missed it. You know, that's probably no harm, no foul. But if you have 100 of them and you knowingly put it down because you need that money, I'd have some concerns on that.
Well, and we cleared up earlier this week, Paul, one of the early misconceptions of the program was that permanent resident employees or any employee working with a green card would not be qualified. But USDA cleared all of that up this week, right?
They cleared up H-2A and H-2B. I don't know if they've cleared up temporary workers here on a green card. They might be here 3 years, but is their principal residence still outside the U.S.? Many of them are, you know, as soon as they're done here working, it might be 5 years, but as soon as they're done working, they're going back to New Zealand or back to Netherlands or wherever it might be. We're going to need even better guidance than what we have. I know USDA on their Q&A cleared up H-2A and H-2B, but right. You know, some of the other workers out here on certain cards, that might be a little bit problematic.
Yeah, and we know that both on dairy farms and hog farms, you know, foreign-born workers make up the majority of our workforce.
Yeah, and for those, even if they're here legally, are they here temporarily and they're going to head home, you know, after 2 or 3 years of working here and making some money? The ones certainly that are here illegally that are employed and those are found out, those will probably be excluded. I don't think you'll get in trouble if you've gone through E-Verify and so on, but that's for dairies and hog producers, that's going to be a mess.
Yes, that's called a conundrum here. And to defend a little bit the process, just go through what we fully understand the Farm Bill implementation. It usually takes weeks, if not months, for USDA to roll out the rules and regulations. And on the one hand, this government moved very fast, not only in Congress to getting this thing approved, but then to announce it officially and to start it up. So that there are a lot of kinks, it's very normal here. But maybe with this additional one that Paul mentioned, where they're going to clarify some of the kinks in the next, you know, legislation, maybe that'll help go a long ways to you know, clear a lot of things up.
Yeah, and I certainly don't want to sound like I'm throwing SBA under the bus. I mean, they actually got quite a bit of guidance out in, like I say, Jim, this is probably the fastest time period we've ever seen government work. I mean, within a week, they had some guidance out. And like I say, when you're dealing with the IRS, we're still waiting for lots of guidance on the tax bill that was passed at the end of 2017. You know, that's almost 2.5 years ago. We still don't have guidance. So the SBA actually worked pretty quickly. You can tell that Treasury and USDA has been communicating with SBA and giving them some guidance. So that's been very helpful. Treasury has provided Q&A. USDA has provided Q&A. SBA has provided Q&A. So they're responding fairly quickly. Certainly on the self-employment side, that is a tougher thing that you have to provide guidance on, because what is self-employment income? Are you strictly looking at what shows up on the Schedule SE, or do you bring in the other income? Because if you look at the law, it talks about self-employed, but then it also talks about earnings, it talks about receipts and so on. Does that allow the self-employed farmer that might not qualify because their SE doesn't show enough income, but they have other sources that really are farm related, does that allow them to qualify for a larger amount? We just need guidance on that.
Are there any other you know, questions or topics that you would want Congress and the administration to know, Paul, on this program?
I think certainly my blog so far, I've brought up most of them. We have internally, we do have probably a list of about 10 or 12 items, but I think a lot of that has already been disseminated. Some stuff has already been answered in Q&As. I'm sure over the next week or so, Jim, I will be providing some more blog posts on here's the law, but what does it mean? You know, I'm sure I'll be doing that for sure.
Relative to the EIL, that's the economic injury disaster loan program. There is a push to make farms eligible. Have you got any update on that, Paul?
I thought, and this is just my memory, I thought the Senate provision last night added in a thing saying that farmers qualify. What I just read from a senator from Hawaii, I'm not sure which senator it is, everybody was automatically assuming that they'd qualify for a $10,000 grant, you know, that they wouldn't have to pay back. It would reduce the loan forgiveness on the PPP, but they wouldn't have to pay it back, and it'd be quicker to get that. What I saw on the release that I saw in a press release from them is the SBA, because of demand, has cut that down to a $1,000 per employee grant. So if a farmer has two employees, they qualify for a $2,000 grant under EIDL, assuming that farmers are going to be eligible. They're not eligible yet, but assuming they become eligible. And actually, the law says that. The law says that they're eligible for up to a $10,000 grant, so that gives the SBA leeway to define however they want that to be. So, yeah, we're still waiting on, you know, I know the Senate last week, several senators sent a strongly worded letter to SBA to make farmers eligible. I know the American Farm Bureau, you know, multiple farm organizations definitely are working on getting that implemented.
Yes, and I know we had, you know, ranking member House Ag Committee, Mike Conaway, Republican from Texas, on AgriTalk, what, 2 weeks ago, John? And he said it was clear congressional intent to make farms eligible for EIDL, and a number of lawmakers have said the same thing. Paul, a dicey one and a complex one. I've got to see how to phrase this. What are the, if a farming operation usually gets aid or other program assistance through USDA type programs, how does that mesh with the SBA assistance? Or is there any chance of a double dipping here, or do they, is it allowed, or do you have to be careful?
Yeah, I you know, when you look at the provision, you know, you look at section 1102 of the CARES Act, it doesn't say anything about eliminating or reducing the loan available to a farm operation because of any funding from USDA. There's nothing in there. Now, there's certainly, I think, some SBA programs that have that, but I was also listening to a House representative person on a webinar about a week ago that in that discussion, he had stated that farmers don't qualify for the PPP loan because they qualify under USDA. And they were saying that the intent of Congress, now this is a representative, and that was the words that he used, the intent of Congress was that farmers should go to USDA and FSA and so on, not to SBA. But that's not the law. That's not how it was written. And now you have Conaway saying, oh, no, the intent of Congress was this is a program for any business, and that was underlined. I underlined it in the CARES Act. It's very clear any business qualifies for these loans. So when they use those words, unless there's an exclusion later on, that means any business. And even the SBA, the SBA has a list of excluded businesses, such as lobbying businesses and so on. I think the CARES Act trumps the listing that the SBA has, because it says any small business concern, which would eliminate those. But then the next words are, or, well, they don't use the word or, it's a comma, but it's or any business concern. So to me, any business concern, even if they're on the SBA list, unless it's for fraud or, you know, some of those sin businesses, maybe, those are not allowed. I mean, those should be allowed. So
words are important. Yeah, and any legislation, especially in this tax or your loan area, what you always look for are exclusions and definitions. And I know you know that. Yeah. But that's what usually analysts look at. Definitions, exclusions.
Yep. Yep.
Hey, Paul, exactly. Another thing that we got questions about early on is the revenue caps. And there was a lot of confusion about which programs the revenue caps apply to and which they don't. Can you just address that for listeners really quick?
Yeah, and again, that comes back to what the SBA was used to. And again, in Section 1102 of the CARES Act, it starts off with the small business concern as defined by the SBA. So the SBA, I think when they saw those words, they automatically went to their material. And in their material, there is a industry listing for almost every industry under the NAS codes or the NAICS, I think. So like hog farmers, corn farmers, cotton farmers, they all have their own industry code. And if you look at that size, it's either based on revenue or it's based on employees or it's based on both. So in that, for all the farm operations, it's showing a $1 million revenue cap. So all the SBA were thinking, uh-oh, you know, farmers, if they're over $1 million, they don't apply. But again, the law as written said, any small business concern can qualify. So farmers under $1 million qualify, plus any other business concern, which would be any farm operation with less than 500 employees, or you could go all the way up to 1,500 employees. If you were like a gold mining company or some of those other companies, manufacturing companies could be 1,250 or 1,500. So that's why I think, and rightfully so, the SBA people were getting confused because they were going off of their rules that a small business concern for a farm only qualifies if their revenue is under $1 million, not realizing the law expanded it much broader and said any business concern with less than 500 employees, no matter the revenue, you could have $1 billion of revenue and still qualify for the PPP loan. And also they came out later on a couple of days ago and clarified in their Q&A that they have a small business concern that says that if your tangible net worth, so that's your net worth, and it's based on, I think, GAAP, it's not based on fair market value, but if your tangible net worth was less than $15 million and your last two tax returns had less than $5 million of taxable income, then you're automatically a small business concern, even if your revenues were over $1 million. So that was sort of the confusion, but really the bottom line now is any farm operation with less than 500 employees automatically qualifies.
Paul, in a more general area, how in agriculture, more from the agribusiness rather than the individual farmer, how do they incentivize bringing people back to work when some people are saying the stimulus rescue package is benefiting them so well? Is that a concern in farm country?
I think there's a little bit of concern because, you know, for almost every state that I'm aware of that's under a COVID-19 shutdown, all farms are considered to be essential operations. They're all allowed to be in production. You know, out in our area, we're right in the middle of spring planting. You know, if you looked at the farm operations out here, you know, to some degree, we really haven't been affected by COVID as far as on the labor side, as far as getting the work done. Now, certain other areas, I know there's issues. So, yeah, that's certainly, you know, what's the political or the politics on that. But, you know, farmers, a lot of farmers, you know, the produce guys, the milk guys, the livestock guys, because of this COVID destroying their demand, they're definitely suffering. So I think they still would have some sympathy. Now, the row crop people, you know, maybe not so much right now. But again, if they delay announcing anything for the row crop until after July when that extra CCC money comes in, maybe by then it'll die down a little bit.
Okay, John, any other questions?
I think you guys covered pretty much everything. And again, a reminder that when we post this on agweb.com, we'll have a link to all of those columns that Paul has written. And Paul, just a tremendous thank you for all of the work you've done to dig into this and answer questions for our listeners and our readers. It's been invaluable, and I know you'll continue to do it over the coming weeks as we get more information about all of these programs.
I thought the last time I really had to dig into something was 199A, not realizing, nope, I still got to dig into something else.
Yep.
True. Right, I wanted to give you some late-breaking news, John. USDA just announced marketing loan terms have been extended to 12 months. This is one of many things that the USDA is trying to do to alleviate some pressure out there.
Yeah, well, and of course, they have to do it for their own needs, too, because they don't have staff in the FSA offices. So all of these programs, they need to extend the window for them just to be able to handle it from, you know, the limited staff that they have on hand.
Okay. All right. So I think we've got a time constraint. We got to allow the studio for Chip now, right?
We do, but before we go, we have to finish up the show like we do every week, and we're going to include Paul in this one, too, as we look ahead to where we find Signal in the coming week. So we're going to start with you, Paul. Where are you going to be watching for Signal over Noise in the coming week?
Oh, I think my signal for sure, either today or tomorrow, I better see a signal from SBA on how self-employed calculations are done for the PPP program. I know that's for sure. That's something I want not next week. I want that by tomorrow.
All right. Thanks, Annalisa.
So watching this dairy stuff to see what's going to happen and what Purdue will do, particularly related to food purchases and the dairy margin coverage program.
All right. And Jim Wiesmeyer.
Two major ones. The first one is to shake out some more details of this coming ag aid package. And I think it will shake out next week. We'll get rumors, if not the announcement. And two, the administration is asking questions for the ag portion of phase one with China. Should we give them an extension? Et cetera, et cetera. I think they will give them an extension on their purchase commitments, John, but I'll be working on that as well.
All right. We'll be looking for all of that. And like you said, we have to clear the way in the studio for His Highness Chip Flory. He's got a little show called AgriTalk to do in here, so we'll get out of his way. We'll be back. Is that a little cough from Chip I hear in the background
that
there?
That might have been. Great show, you guys. Great conversation, you guys. This was absolutely outstanding. I was eavesdropping.
All right. Thanks, Chip. All right. Well, that's it for this week's DC Signal to Noise. I'm John Harris. Special thanks to Paul Niefer for all of that information on those loan programs today. Annalisa Laca, the dairy editor for Farm Journal. And, of course, Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers policy analyst. That wraps up this week's edition of DC Signal to Noise.